All right, for a message this morning, I was going to finish up with the book of James. I've been in nothing remotely close to consecutive order, working my way through this. Last week we took some thoughts from James, and so today I wanted to read James chapter 5 and take some thoughts from this for a message. Here's this very practical man giving practical advice for real people in church life that they face the temptations, the realities of life, decisions around different things, sickness, what to do about money, and just practical things, practical advice that James has given us here in chapter 5. So maybe I'll just read this to begin with and then share some thoughts from this. James 5, "Go to now, you rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you, and you shall eat your flesh as it were fire. You have heaped treasure together for the last days. Behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth, and the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabbath. You have lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton. You have nourished your hearts as in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and killed the just, and he doth not resist you. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and hath long patience for it, until he receive the early and latter rain. Be ye also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. Grudge not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. Behold, the judge standeth before the door. Take, my brethren, the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering affliction and of patience. Behold, we count them happy which endure. You have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay, lest you fall into condemnation. Is any among you afflicted? Let him pray. Is any merry? Let him sing psalms. Is any sick among you? Let him call for the elders of the church, and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith shall save the sick, and the Lord shall raise him up. And if he hath committed sins, they shall be forgiven him. Confess your faults one to another, and pray for one another, that ye may be healed. The effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Elias was a man subject to like passions as we are, and he prayed earnestly that it might not rain, and it rained not on the earth but the space of 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth brought forth her fruit. Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth, and one convert him, let him know that he which converteth a sinner from the error of his ways shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins." James starts out here in this passage addressing the concept of riches and the discourse on it that he has here is extremely negative, very much kind of against what's happening here with this rich man. And he addresses different of the things that that people face, how they react, what they deal with, when their focus is extremely much on riches and being wealthy. I sat with a man for lunch this past week in the course of our conversation. He brought up Elon Musk and he just seemed to be in awe of the man for his creativity and his foresight and his ability to kind of be ahead of the curve and think about things and he mentioned that this man Elon is likely to be the world's first trillionaire. I think it's, you know, if you look at the news, it probably is. And our discussion was started out kind of talking about the electricity and how the price of electricity is changing so much here in the Northwest. Has to do with these AI centers and all of the data that they have to crunch and the electric use because of this. And his version was, A lot of the electricity that goes into those things is for cooling, to keep these processors cooled down. So he said, well, Mr. Elon is going to beat the system. He's going to send his AI processing into space and put his all the computers up there where he has absolute zero for a temperature to work with, and he don't have to work at cooling them down, and run them maybe with a small nuclear reactor, and they just beat the whole system. And he just was amazed at this man. But one thing that kind of came through in the conversation was, now he talked about, you know, his money and how he's been using Grok to do his investing, and it just has changed his whole approach to it. And you know, this was kind of, it was plain, this was kind of a big deal to him, what to do with the money that he had kind of accumulated, how to keep that going forward without, you know, how to deal with it in inflation, and you know, just his mind was consumed with how to protect and promote and move this thing of riches forward. And I thought about that in relation to this verse here, where riches are corrupted and garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you. And I suppose when a rich man gets to the end of life, I know this is how it is, and he stands before God, he will take none of it with him anyway. And the condemnation is here of a wasted life, a wasted concern. Weep in hell for your miseries that shall come upon you, it says. And how that these things are so tentative, so transitionary. The psalmist, or was it in Proverbs, where it talked about them, the riches make themselves wings and fly away. And what can be done about it? James here is condemning the all-consuming accumulation of wealth for personal pleasure. There it talks about, well, first it addresses the fraud, you know, the intensity around accumulation driving people to do things that are unethical there in verse 4, keeping back by fraud, something that you were supposed to, you had agreed to give, and God hears and notices. So, again, just the temptation there to be fraudulent in the accumulation of wealth, and I think that's just so true as we observe the world we're in. And somewhere recently I listened to a documentary where this man was a trader, a day trader, and I don't know what all some of the things he was trading, I didn't even understand what the terms were, but he worked for some small bank in England, I believe, and he had an office in Singapore, and his duty was to trade for the bank, trade these derivatives and options, and I don't know what all he was doing, but the problem was he started to get behind, started to lose money. In order to protect himself and his image, he started to cook the books, if you will. And that pot that he was cooking just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And he had to keep more and more fraudulent stuff. And eventually he was sending approvals with falsified signatures from his home fax machine to get these transactions to go through as the hole he dug for himself kept getting deeper and deeper. And I just sensed a man who was wrapped up in this wealth and what this is and what it can do and just the loss, just immersed in money and what it is and accumulation of it. And I think that's at least partially what's in focus here. It's just the short-sightedness of both, you know, a life that is wrapped up with that, and the idea that God sees, God knows, and the idea that the uselessness of a big pile of rusty gold and silver, the uselessness. And so James is just kind of the stance was, what a waste, something to be avoided, not to be too admired and sought after. It also talks about the wantonness and the selfishness of living in pleasure while those around you are hungry. You don't meet those needs. You just waste it on yourself. And I think it's just something good for us to remember. Do we share? Do we, as we can, reach out and allow our finances to bless others? How big of a deal do we make? How much admiration do we have for wealthy people? people? Or is the accumulation or the profit that we earn, the intent is to use it for God's glory, to use it for His kingdom, to use it to bless and help others, to move His program forward? It also talks about kind of the unfair advantage that often goes along with money there in verse 6. At least that's one thing we could read into it. It says, "You have condemned and killed the just, and he doth not resist you." And so there's almost seems like with that, the power, I mean, with the wealth comes the power to kind of bend the rules and make other people who were just suffer because of your focus on accumulation. So James very much here has a negative picture of just kind of a hyper-focus on the accumulation of wealth. The next topic that he addresses here is this idea of patience. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. And this was good advice for me. You know, I think my nature, my personality maybe lends itself to being impatient, to wanting things to move forward, to being done with the current dysfunction that I'm stuck in, and why can't we move this forward? And he reminds us that the earth to the Lord is like a farmer here. He planted the fruit. He said fruit, so maybe it's a tree, and some of those trees can take a long time to start producing. And the idea is that the Lord's working on something of value that is coming. And the tediousness and this discomfort of the day-to-day living comes with that thought. Be patient, because it's not about this day-to-day tedious discomfort. It's about what we're trying to grow, the goal. I think that's a good thing for maybe you mothers, as you think about the struggles of little children and all of the tremendous amount of effort that goes into that. I think it can be this way, where it's just you can feel trapped and the struggle is real, and it just takes patience. But the reminder is, remember, we're building something. This is of value, and be patient as we remember that this whole effort is for eternity. And it says that the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. Jesus is coming soon. And isn't the thing that we are building for eternity of value? Remember that when we go into the next tedious day of cleanup or whatever. You get the point being that it's a reminder, it's an encouragement, it's a valuable thing that we're building for eternity. Be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. In verse 9 then, he uses this word, grudge, not one against another. And I was kind of, I looked that up at Strong's then. What's that grudge? Well, I understand what a grudge is. That is kind of a down the lines of unforgiveness or holding something against someone or being unwilling to move past some offense that was caused. And as I looked into this, there's some of that idea, just what I would consider to be the normal English definition of grudge. But it was more of the emphasis, one of exasperation or having to put up with somebody, I think he used the word a big sigh as you think about somebody. Grudge not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. And that put it a slightly different context on it for me. Do you ever just get exasperated with somebody? Just here we go again. Put up with them and just. You know, the attitude in the end is not very redemptive. It's not very helpful. It's not very edifying. But here we go, and we have to put up with this person. That's a little bit the idea as I dug into that word grudge, what it actually, the emphasis would be. And it makes verse 10 make just a little bit more sense when you think about it that way. It says, "Take my brethren the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering affliction and of patience." If you look back at the prophets of the Old Testament, you know, those men of God put up with some stuff. You know, often some of them were speaking and preaching to very hard-hearted people that had turned away, people that were, you know, well, even God, when I think about Moses, the prophet there, God told Moses, "Get out of the way. I'm going to get rid of these people, and we'll start over." And so God himself ended up in a place where These people had tried his patience to the point that they deserve no more long suffering and mercy, and it was time to do something different. And so he, James here, is holding up these prophets, these godly men from the past, who, in dealing with the people around them, got into some really exasperating situations. But yet, they didn't allow that, the fact of the exasperating people they were working with, keep them from testifying of the goodness and the laws and the direction and the requirements of God. They just shared it anyway, even with the people who maybe didn't deserve it. And they took it with suffering, it says. You think about that as you interact with people. And for their good, bring a message and live a life for their good, even if it causes you to suffer, and don't be exasperated by it. So it's a high calling as we work with each other and work with those in our community to live like the prophets did, be willing to share in exasperating circumstances, not hold it against them for the situation they were in. And I think about men like Daniel, again, we've talked about him before, who used the words we when he talked about the sin, but I find him to be a man of God who was serving God and likely was serving God before they were hauled off to Babylon. And so as he looked around him, he could have been in a position to say, you know, I'm here hauled off and held against my will and forced to do this in this strange land, and really it's your fault. Why wouldn't you serve God? And then God could have blessed us there in Jerusalem where we were, in the land of Israel. And so, again, just an example of a willingness to love those around them, even when it's even when it costs you and it's exasperating. Here, that's what James is telling us to do. So there's very practical ways to make that real in our lives. Verse 12 kind of is in the middle of there. But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by another oath, but let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay, lest you fall into condemnation. And this is closely tied to the previous verse, previous chapter that we looked at last week. It says, for that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. And I think the message here is, one, to be honest, just to be honest, forthright, careful in our speech, to not have to pepper our speech with a lot of I guarantees and I swear and this, and you know how it is. There's so many ways that we can emphasize the fact that now I'm telling the truth. But rather, live a life of that your speech is one that people trust what you say, that you say the truth. And I have found many times in business life, interacting with men who, when talking about a mutual acquaintance, they'll say something like, well, that guy's a straight shooter. And well, what do they mean by that? Well, what they mean by that is he'll tell it to you how it is. Maybe you don't like it sometimes, but he won't be one that you'll find him shading or embellishing or trying to put one over on you or confuse you or gain an advantage by being slightly dishonest in his emphasis. That's what he is. He'll tell you the truth. He's a good guy, and he conducts his business that way. And I thought, so that's a good goal. It's a good way to be known in the business world. If someone talks about me, do they consider me to be a straight shooter, or is it something that they feel like they have to watch their back? I don't know. You better be careful. He bears watching, and there's plenty of that in life too. But to let our words be honest, and I think there's a deep side to this. Passage. Not that you go are dishonest, but that you recognize in saying yes and no that God is finally in control. And I can't change tomorrow. I can't change the future. There might be something that comes up that I say. I said I will try to do that. I will be there. I will do what I say, but life happens. Maybe there's something, some flat tire, some event that makes so that what you had agreed to do, you're not able to. And so life, well, the idea we can't make one hair white or black, or we can't add to our stature, you know, the message from the gospel that we can't change that. So we live and we conduct ourselves and our speech and our communication with the idea that this is the truth that I have. This is what I have, or I can't change tomorrow. And I live under the reality of the will of God might be different, might change something for me. So I'm not finally all powerful that can change the world to make a difference. So be careful with our speech. It's interesting that he uses the above all things, my brethren. And just a reminder for us that there are different places in the legal side of our American society, getting your passport or signing documents, or you know, maybe you're called into court somewhere for some reason. There are many places. Michael and I were called in. One of our air compressors were stolen a while back, and we called the cops. And long story short, we actually caught the guy in the act of called the cops, and he came out, and we took our air compressor back. Well, through that whole thing, we were called in to a grand jury, and all that was to decide whether or not there was enough evidence to have a court trial. Well, we weren't pressing charges, but it was out of our hands, and this guy kind of had a record, and so we got in. So do you swear to tell the truth? Question asked. What do you say? Well, in our land, we have the option to affirm. We can say, yes, that's what I will tell the truth. And so I think we do well to be careful, not to just kind of theorize this idea, but be careful. Try to actually make sure that we're not swearing. Above all things. That's quite a statement. I'm not sure why he brought that forward. Maybe someone else has some insight on that later. Then going to the passage here on prayer. Is any among you afflicted? Let him pray. Is any merry? Let him sing songs. Is any sick among you? And we practice this as an ordinance. If someone has maybe a chronic or a serious illness that they're facing, we follow through on this, where we'd actually call for the elders of the church to come and have a special anointing service and pray over the person, because prayer makes a difference. Do you believe that? And I just remember a while ago, someone I knew actually was from the business industry, the hydraulic industry and business. And he was a man who was quite talented, an engineer, had helped us on some things. He was really good. And we got to know him. And here's a man who suddenly was facing cancer, kind of life-threatening cancer. And he called a friend of mine and asked him, and it was kind of out of character. He wasn't a person of faith that we knew of. And yet suddenly faced with this terminal situation and the fear and the kind of the what to do, the desperation that a person who doesn't have God feels when they're faced with something like that. It can be devastating. And he called him up and said, "Hey, will you pray for me? Will you pray for me?" And I just thought that was just such a good spot to be in life, that when your acquaintances, maybe it's your friends, your neighbors, your business associates, when they get into some real trouble that is beyond their control and they need help, and they would love to connect with God who can make a difference, do they think of you for someone to pray for them? Quite a testimony, aspiration. Be a person of prayer, that when someone needs help, when someone wants to connect with God, because the prayer is finally of a righteous man, the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man makes a difference. Makes a difference. And he likens it here to this man Elias, who was able, through his connection with God, to stop the rain for, how many does it say here? It didn't rain for the space of 3 years and 6 months just because Elijah prayed. What a connection, and you know, what an example. I mean, when I think about Elijah and some of his stories, the prophets of Baal, and you know, you just go through the story of Elijah. Here is a man that he prayed, stuff happened. Stuff happened. It was amazing. Fire fell and burned stuff up, and it was just. And here's a man who had a connection with God. James says, "Here's a man with like passions as us." Subject to like passions as we are. So here's a real man. Here's a real man. Sure, it was under the old covenant. Sure, he was given a special task by God. But nevertheless, he's a real man. But faced with all of the doubts and the struggles and the human nature that we all face. And yet, somehow through that all, he had a tremendous connection with God. When he prayed, God answered. Let's be that. Let's think. Let's aspire to that. Let's work towards that. Let's keep our prayer life up so that we are in connection with this God who made it all. I went over verse 16 there. Confess your faults one to another. Often this is part of a anointing service. But I think it's a big part when we are serious about needing connection with God to look at our lives. Do I have something that is hindering our prayers? And the New Testament talks about different things. You know, talk about the relationship of a husband and wife, that it's carefully handled, that your prayers be not hindered. It talks about that. And so there are things that can get in the ways of our prayers, including our faults. And so we are to acknowledge it. To tell each other, to confess to each other our faults, that we can find healing through it all. All right, then, the last two verses. Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth and one convert him, let him know that he which converteth a sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death, shall hide a multitude of sins. I was thinking about these verses in light of our Sunday school discussion about forgiveness, where we're trying to, finally, that's the goal, even for those that have wronged us. And that's how Jesus is. Those that have wronged him, including us, the goal is for their salvation. It's one of the big things that's so bad about unforgiveness is it hampers that. It confuses that. It refuses to help make that person's salvation a priority. Even if they have wronged us, even if they haven't found their way to correcting their life, even if they are still out of line, our forgiveness helps us hold out this opportunity for them to repent. Remember these things. Verse 19 there, it talks about someone who maybe was in the truth, but somehow fell away. He something, the cares of this life, the deceitfulness of riches, the pleasures of other things, out of some reason that he fell away. And talks about our participation in that recovery. It says, "And one convert him." So it's of your effort, it's your thoughtfulness, it's your carefulness, your willingness to be used to share the truth of God is what can finally convert somebody. And so that's just a reminder that in our daily living, as we interact with whoever it is. Part of our effort is to convert someone, to help him recover from the error of his ways. And it modulates, modifies your conduct and your words as you respond and you relate to others. Let him know that he which converteth a sinner from the error of his ways shall save a soul from death and hide a multitude of sins. The error, the reminder is, finally, eternity is at stake. People that fall away from God end up in death, save a soul from death. That's the end result of someone who is in error and is living in sin. So remember, that's what we are all about, is relate to each other and in this community.